The Democratic Party convention assembled on June 1st in Baltimore and, as expected, quickly deadlocked. After the 48th ballot, North Carolina Congressman James C. Dobbin delivered an unexpected and passionate speech endorsing Franklin Pierce, which launched a wave of support for him. On the 49th ballot, Pierce received all but six of the votes, winning the nomination. Delegates selected Alabama Senator William R. King, a Buchanan supporter, as Pierce's running mate, and adopted a platform that rejected further agitation over slavery and supported the Compromise of 1850. When word reached New Hampshire of the result, Franklin Pierce was dumbfounded, and his wife fainted. Their son Benjamin wrote to his mother hoping that Franklin Pierce's candidacy would fail because he knew that she would not like to live in Washington. Could such a long-shot candidate become president today? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me to get into the phenomenon of the presidential nominating system, if you could call it that, is Barry Burden, professor of political science at the UW-Madison, and welcome to University of the Air.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, that was certainly a spectacular example from American history of the nomination process, one of the more famous ones, Franklin Pierce. And of course, it did not result in one of the greatest presidencies in American history either. We have another extraordinary year ahead of us in 2024, and extraordinary in, well, various obvious ways and less so obvious, but we have Trump versus Biden, and how did that come about?
It is an unusual path for both of them. This is probably the easiest path the two major party nominees have had to their conventions in contemporary history, at least, especially for the out party that's not the White House. They would typically have a competitive primary process, and that didn't happen this year. Donald Trump has pretty much cruised to the nomination, assuming there's no health or legal problems that trip him up between now and July. He'll be nominated in Milwaukee. So just completely unusual. Otherwise, it reflects sort of the modern system pretty well, though. There are two party conventions. They're a few weeks apart, one in Milwaukee, one in Chicago. There will be thousands of people, delegates, reporters, interest groups, and others who show up at those events. And there will be some speeches and some primetime packaged material for the public to watch, and vice presidential candidates announced. And then we launch into the general election campaign. So they are still a really important marker that separates stuff that isn't the general election, really, from the time when the public and the media and others really begin to tune in to what's happening headed to November.
Well, how did the choices actually come about?
This year on the Republican side, you know, there were other Republicans who competed in the primaries and caucuses.
Yeah, about eight of them, at least.
Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, and so on. And they did participate in debates. They did raise money. They did try to accumulate endorsements. But most of that was unsuccessful. There were several Republican debates. Donald Trump didn't participate in any of them without any apparent harm to his campaign. The other candidates had a very difficult time getting endorsements from any leaders in the Republican Party. They have mostly lined up behind Trump. And that is very unusual for a party to turn back to a previous nominee who has lost the last campaign, albeit he was a president before that. He did serve 4 years in office. But typically, once a party loses an election, they will walk away as fast as possible from that loser and not barely recognize them as members of the party and certainly not want to re-endorse them. So that was true when Mitt Romney lost the nomination as a Republican in 2012. That was true when John Kerry lost as a Democrat in 2004, Walter Mondale for the Democrats well before that. They are in the past very quickly, and the party tries to find someone else or some other message to be successful, realizing that that person had not been successful. So to go with Trump again and so quickly and enthusiastically really is a surprise.
It's happened, so far as I know, only once in American history. That was the case of Grover Cleveland, who had a term. And then Benjamin Harrison beat him, and then Cleveland comes back and gets it again.
That's right. That's the only other comparison, really. And Trump is even different from that because he lost the popular vote both times. He ran for president and is impeached twice and is indicted and has a number of other things that make him an unusual person. Comes out of the entertainment and business world rather than government or military or something else. It's not even that common to have rematches of candidates. Again, because parties typically move on, they tend not to re-nominate someone who has lost an election. I think the last rematch was in 1956 when Eisenhower and Stevenson went at it again. And the result was exactly the same as in 1952 when Eisenhower romped.
Well, what was going on within the party, the Republican Party, we'll get to the Democrats later. I think a simpler story there probably. But in the Republican Party, what was going on during this pre-election process, if you want to call it that, in terms of deciding who's going to get the nomination?
Yeah, this is how parties now make decisions. It's very much in public view. Before conventions happen, in those months, even years leading up to it, it's a period that used to be called the invisible primary because it was sort of behind the scenes, wheeling and dealing, candidates trying to line up support and traveling the country and doing those kinds of things. Now it's very visible. The debates, the fundraising, the advertisements. Candidates who are thinking about running will typically publish a book. They will travel the country. They will give away copies of the book. They will have a website and, you know, often an organization they create to raise money and support their travels and those kinds of things. So it's all very much in public view, and it's lengthy. It's so unlike campaigns in every other part of the world, other democracies.
It's about, what, like 2 years by the time you have to make that first, register or whatever the process is formally, but also just to get the word out that you will be a candidate.
Yeah, it typically is the midterm election that precedes the presidential that is kind of the starting blocks. And very quickly by the next year, early in the next year, the candidates need to be in the race because for this cycle, the debates started in July 2023. So that was just 6 months after the people elected in 2022 had taken office. And if you're going to be trying to hire good staff and lock down pollsters and consultants and other people you'll need, all the candidates are racing to get those same professionals on board. You need to not wait.
Are there legalities as to who can become a candidate in terms of filing and fundraising and that kind of thing?
There aren't many beyond what's in the Constitution. You know, the requirements to serve as president, to be a U.S. born a U.S. citizen, age 35. That's about it. So if you're willing to run a campaign and think you can raise the money, you're a candidate. Even if you can't do those things, you can still be a candidate.
And overwhelmingly, it's a matter of being in one of the two big parties.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning there are other parties in the United States. They just don't get much traction. Once in a while, there's a little flourish of a third-party candidate or an independent candidate who does well. We have some who are making some noise this year. The No Labels group is trying to get on the ballot in a bunch of states. Robert Kennedy Jr. is running as a candidate, just announced his running mate. And they often those parties, if they are parties, will have their own conventions and nominating process. The Libertarians, the Greens, the Constitution Party all have something similar, but it tends to be very disorganized, not well covered, sometimes chaotic even.
Never happens in the major parties.
No. The major parties do have a lot of stakeholders who have an interest in having a successful convention. And that's one reason conventions have changed so much over time is the parties realize these are opportunities to market themselves, to unify the party as they turn from the nomination period to the general election campaign. So their firepower is trained on the opposing party rather than on each other. So kind of to get their ducks in a row, the convention's a nice place to do that. And as a result, the national media have decided not to cover the convention so much because they're not as interesting to watch and listen to. And that has in turn forced the parties to really compress the material they want to deliver to voters into about an hour each night. Even though these things are happening all day sort of all day affairs, there's this 1 or 2 hour period in the prime time when the conventions and the media have agreed, okay, this is what we're delivering to the public.
Well, what's the interrelationship between the candidate and the party in terms of putting the planks in the platform?
Yeah, there is a platform process. There are two or three things that conventions do. One is they nominate candidates for president and vice president. Two is they write a platform that will be kind of the defining document of the party heading into that year's election. And should they win, will be a kind of blueprint for what they would do in office. And it actually is fairly guiding in terms of what parties do when they win. They act on the things they say they're going to do. And parties have been writing platforms in this way since the 1860s, when we established really the two-party system we have today. That process will get underway this spring as the nominations wrap up. The parties will start to hold meetings around the country where delegates or national committee members can attend and work through issues. They'll have hearings where they'll hear from interested parties, groups, activists, various factions in the party, and they will testify as to what they think ought to be on the platform. And that gets built. It's often a kind of unifying device to throw a bone to various interests in the party. In 2020, when the Democrats were putting together their platform, there was a lot of interest in reaching out to the Bernie Sanders wing of the party.
Well, yes. I mean, in order to get a majority, and you have large factions interested in one thing or another, you have to see how big you can make your tent, don't you?
You do. Typically, that's the process. Yeah. So it has this internal purpose of getting everybody together, and then it has an external purpose of communicating to the public. And, the things that Sanders was advocating for, like a Green New Deal, ended up in the platform and ended up as part of the Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Biden signed into office. So there's a very direct line from Sanders being a formidable candidate in the primaries to seeing it actually as part of public policy. Now, the one exception to all this in 160 years is the Republicans last time around. They decided not to draft a platform in 2020. First time that's happened since the Civil War.
Sounds like it could have been a bit of a mistake.
I don't know. It was a choice. The Republicans said, on one hand, they didn't think it was proper to draft a platform when they couldn't have a real in-person convention, because it's at that convention where the final document is solidified. The Democrats, of course, did have one, so it seems possible. But they were concerned that it might not be representative of the party. What the party ended up doing instead of writing a platform was to adopt a brief resolution, a one-page resolution that essentially said, we stand behind whatever Donald Trump wants to do, and we're going to let the 2016 platform continue because he helped draft that. So it was really a statement of loyalty to him as an individual. That is a very unusual thing. It's unusual that a party would renominate someone like that after having lost the popular vote twice. But it's additionally unusual to say our platform is essentially whatever he says it is.
At what point and what would go into the thinking behind it would a candidate then announce a vice presidential running mate?
Running mates are usually announced at the convention or just before the convention. It's one of the few things that are uncertain when we go into the convention. Everything else is known. The platform is pretty much worked out. We know who the nominees will be nowadays. We know who the lineup of primetime speakers will be. We could probably already imagine who those might be today. So announcing the running mate is the one piece of interest that's really going to develop there. And it's only on the side of the out party. So only for Donald Trump do we not know who the running mate will be. And we know it's not going to be Mike Pence again.
Pretty good idea of that.
They have parted ways, but there's a whole list of people now being floated as possible running mates. And that will, if Trump follows tradition, that will be announced just a day or two before the convention, or maybe the first night of the convention. It tends to kind of electrify the delegates and generate a lot of buzz in the convention hall.
I've heard some interesting speculation recently in the press about possible running mates for Donald Trump and the strategy that might be behind them. And it's sort of a dark idea, but since the running mate is once in office as vice president, one heartbeat away from the presidency, you would want to pick, according to this theory, a running mate who is like frightening. And therefore, you want to make sure that you do not get removed from office by a vote that would involve either or both parties.
Interesting theory. Trump is an unconventional politician, so he might do things that wouldn't have been the traditional pattern.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, was mentioned by Jonah Goldberg.
Yes, she's on the list. I think she's a plausible candidate for Trump. She's shown her real loyalty to him. She's outspoken. She's a public presence. She's on, podcasts and cable news outlets an awful lot. The traditional pattern is that the nominee of the party will select someone who is popular in other segments of the party that they don't represent well to try to pull those wings together. Or if the candidate comes from outside Washington, they will pick someone who has Washington experience, who understands that system. So Trump actually did both with Mike Pence. So he picked someone who was an insider, who'd been in Congress, understood how the place works, had been in Washington. He also picked a real conservative, a religious conservative, a Christian conservative, fiscal conservative, who would placate some of the members of his party who worried that he might not be conservative enough. So it was sort of a bone thrown to them. He might not be interested in satisfying those groups anymore. They have really come around to back him. So I don't think there's the same need to kind of win them over. And he's now a Washington insider, having been president, so he doesn't need that part of things either.
Well, we could easily spend an hour just on the strategy of selecting a running mate. But if you go through history and think about the ones that became president for one reason or another, I think, for example, of Abraham Lincoln, considered by many historians the greatest American president, and by the same standard that you have given, Barry, for geographical and philosophical balance, who does he pick for his second running mate? Was Andrew Johnson, who turns out not to be one of the world's great presidents. It seems like these running mates are not chosen for how effective can they be replacing the president should that happen, but just for the very reason you said, just to get into office, to win the election.
Yeah, there's a lot of importance put on just putting the party together. A party is not a single thing. It's a strange entity that has a lot of aspects or components. And so the national conventions are the one time all of these components are in one room together, or at least one city. And part of its job as a unit, as a convention, is to get everybody on the same train, on the same path, pointed in the same direction. And the selection of the running mate, the platform, the speeches, all of those things are an effort to do that.
I'm wondering about some of the contingencies that might go unclaimed between the two parties. Is there ever a substantial voting block that that neither party would try to pull into their tent?
Well, there certainly have been times in American history where that's been the case. I mean, African Americans for so many decades were ignored by both parties, and racial issues, whether they were slavery or the things that came after the Civil War, were really suppressed by both parties. So that was a massive element, a large number of people. I mean, a large share of Americans were African American, but also just an important issue or set of issues in American culture that were kind of swept under the rug by both parties for a long time. So it's sometimes cultural issues like those. Immigration at times has been ignored by both parties. And especially in the 1800s, there were a lot of smaller parties that popped up that were anti-immigrant or had particular immigrant facing concerns, were anti-Catholic, those kinds of things. The Know Nothing Party was a famous one in the late 1800s. So there are times when the parties will sort of collude to either give maybe excessive attention to some issues or no attention to some issues or constituencies. And there will often be a social movement or a party or some combination of things to try to bring those things to the surface.
We're going to look at a remarkable nomination phenomenon that actually, in its own right, if you want to use that word, changed the process. We'll go to that year of 1968, right after this. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Barry Burden, and we're looking at the phenomenon of presidential nominations in the United States. It has changed over the years for one reason and another. Before we get into the year that I mentioned, 1968, that pivotal year, we have to look at how it was done before that for, about 100 years?
Yeah, that's right. These conventions we know today, the primaries and caucuses and all of that that lead up to it, are a relatively new invention in many of our lifetimes. There was something else that was done. Now, keep in mind, the Constitution does not mention political parties. It certainly does not mention conventions. It says a president will be elected and a vice president, and there's an electoral college, but it doesn't give any guidance on how the people will be selected who would be candidates to run in the electoral college.
Well, back then, they just stood for election, right?
Yeah, or even by consensus. You know, George Washington was chosen essentially unanimously by his comrades. But very quickly, as the country grew and the Congress grew in size, there got to be factions within the Congress, and eventually they came to look like parties, kind of elite cadre parties, not the mass political parties we know today. And they had candidates they preferred, they wanted to see as nominees for president, and so they formed their own kind of nomination system initially just within the Congress. It was just members of Congress who would do this. And it makes sense that they would take this task on. They're the only body that represents the entire country. And so they had delegates, if you want to call them. They're representatives from across the country who represented different interests and sectional concerns. And so they took it on themselves to essentially nominate a person for each of the factions or parties as they developed. And that system was in place for about the first few decades of the U.S. history until about the 1830s. Things sort of fell apart because that party system fell apart. And then the U.S. fell into civil war in the 1860s. But after the Civil War, the U.S. comes back together, the Union is reunited, and real political parties now exist the way we recognize them today. National political parties that had a public identity, where there was mass suffrage. The Electoral College is now being based on the popular vote in every state. And so the parties felt a need to organize across the country and to have national conventions to choose nominees. They were not going to give this job just to the Congress anymore. It was going to be more than just elected officials. It would be governors and people out in the states, but also party bosses and leaders and captains of industry, and all of them would be part of the process. So they began having national conventions, typically in the summer before the presidential election, in a big city. And the delegates from the states would gather for a few days in a kind of unruly set of meetings and choose a nominee, and actually a ticket that could run in the fall election. So all of this business that's now very public with primaries and debates and fundraising and news coverage, that was something that was done essentially in a private room, sometimes called a smoke-filled room.
Yeah, it probably was too.
There were cigars and pipes and cigarettes and tobacco used all over the place. And, you know, these were leaders or elites within the parties negotiating with each other over the course of many days to find someone who was broadly acceptable to all the major factions or wings of the party. So in a way, it was a very undemocratic process, right? It's behind closed doors. And these are the names that will be given to the public. You have no choice but to vote for the people chosen at these conventions.
Winner takes all.
Winner take all, essentially. Yeah, majority rule in the Electoral College. But at the convention, it was a somewhat successful process in that it brought the wings of the party together. There was negotiation. Sometimes there were surprise candidates. You mentioned Pierce earlier. Warren Harding was one of those who, in 1920, appeared out of nowhere, because each of the other candidates whose names were on people's minds at the time appealed to some elements within the party, but not all of them. And it would be at the convention sometimes where an unknown or unconsidered candidate would rise to the top, and they would sort of stitch together the elements within the party and come out of it. That process ran for about 100 years. Those were the conventions from about the 1860s until the 1960s. So that's the dominant way we've chosen our party nominees. It's now a relic of history, but it's the longest stretch of any single system.
It would be interesting to see. Of course, it's always subjective when you're evaluating a presidential administration, but it would be interesting to see a correlation between number of ballots required to nominate the candidate who becomes president and the quality of the presidency that follows. I mean, you know, you mentioned Warren G. Harding, and I mentioned Franklin Pierce, and I'm sure there's some other examples of dark horses who should have just stayed out of the race.
Yeah, that's right. Even the idea that there would be multiple ballots comes from that period, because it was a negotiation and there would be compromises made, and often no candidate would have a majority on the first vote. And so someone would drop out. There might be an agreement to endorse another candidate or to get a concession or to pick a running mate of a certain type. The conventions don't look anything like that anymore. There is a first ballot. It's the only ballot. It's often unanimous or close to it for the leading candidate.
Well, it's interesting to see, before we get into the notorious year, is when you get into the debates or even things said in the press of competitors in the nomination process. Take Nikki Haley, for example. she could go only so far, she could get only so strident in attacking Donald Trump, because she had to remain in the Republican Party, or at least she felt that she did. And so I don't know if she's actually endorsed him, but they're always playing, other than somebody like Mike Pence, who's not in the race even, but they're always playing their cards very carefully.
Yeah, it's a fact of American politics that careers in elective office go through the major parties. There aren't really ways to be successful as a politician if you're not operating within a party. So Nikki Haley became a pretty outspoken opponent of Donald Trump and said some harsh things about him late in the primary season. But in the end, she didn't disavow him exactly.
That's right.
And she did not agree to be on the no labels ticket or to consider an independent run. So, you know, she's young and still has, I think, some appeal to a lot of Republican voters, and maybe wants to reserve the possibility of coming back in 4 years or 8 years and being a candidate again. It's very rare for someone like a Liz Cheney to just completely walk away from the party. And she's ruined her chances as a Republican, you know, having a
even
career.
Even in Wyoming.
Even in her home state. She lost her own state primary. So that's an exception, which is partly why she gets so much attention.
Well, yeah, I would say that she's exceptional, certainly. Well, I'm thinking of Ron DeSantis, too, who was in those debates early on, could say not too much about Trump because maybe he'll choose me as his running mate.
That's right. You know, dealing with Trump is a special process because he is known for insulting candidates and going after them pretty directly. So I think some candidates are quite concerned about getting into a one-on-one with him and taking that fire. But it's a hard task with someone like Trump, who is eating up so much of the attention and has so much of the loyalty of the base, to carve out a place for yourself as a Republican, as an opponent to him, as an alternative to him, but not alienate the large number of Republicans who are really in league with Trump. There just seemed to be no place for that this time around.
Of course, the issue of age has come up, although understandably Trump has not played that one up, being only about 4 years younger than Biden. But a lot of Republicans have played it up for Biden. And it made me think back to 1968, that aforementioned year. March 31st, 1968, President Johnson goes on TV to give a speech. I'm not sure that the content was divulged, certainly not in anything but the vaguest way. And he gets to a certain point in the speech, the camera comes in tight on him, and he says, ends a sentence with, "Therefore, I will not seek nor accept your nomination for the President of the United States." In other words, he's not going to run for re-election. It was a real bombshell late in the process. Now, the result in that case, spoiler alert, is that Hubert Humphrey became the candidate and lost to Richard Nixon.
Yeah, what a year.
Yes, and Chicago, Democratic Convention in Chicago, a big media event in its own right because of things that happened around it and because of it. So why the big change, though, in the way things were done in 68 because of that convention?
Yeah, just a little more context about that. You know, Lyndon Johnson had won election in 1964 in a landslide after Kennedy's assassination. So to think that he would not be viable for his own, you know, re-election in his own right 4 years later against a former vice president, Richard Nixon, who was actually out of the business for a while and came back, sort of unbelievable. But what had happened between 64 and 68 was the Vietnam War. And it was increasingly going in an unpopular direction. Casualties were mounting, costs were mounting, and it had no end in sight.
And Johnson had ramped it up.
He certainly had escalated it. And the Tet Offensive had happened early in 68, which was a disaster for the U.S. And so there were anti-war elements within the Democratic Party challenging Johnson. They did not want to see him renominated. Protests on college campuses, lots of other things were part of the news at the time. And he had an official entrant run against him. That was Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was the young anti-war senator challenging the Johnson administration on the war.
Democrat.
Yeah, and challenged him in the New Hampshire primary, which was not a big focus at the time the way it is today, but was one of the early contests and a sitting president should cruise through to easily win the New Hampshire primary without any serious competition. But McCarthy gave him a serious run, and it scared Johnson. And he looked ahead to the other series of primaries that were coming up, one of which was Wisconsin just a few days away, and gave this surprise speech where he said, "I will not be renominated." So this was something, you know, some Democrats had asked Joe Biden to consider doing this year, but it's a different time. It's a different process. He's obviously a different person. There's no Vietnam War. But I think that attests to kind of the difference in the political times from then and now. Anyway, so starting in March, when Johnson bails out, it becomes kind of a wide open nomination process. And the primaries start to get attention in a way they didn't otherwise. So McCarthy continues to run. Bobby Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's brother, who's a former attorney general, U.S. senator, he begins a campaign for president, also as an anti-war candidate. He takes the lead as the candidate who's getting all the attention. Hubert Humphrey is in the mix because he's the vice president, but he's actually not contesting the primaries, really. He's not out on the stump the way Kennedy and McCarthy are. Kennedy begins to roll up victories until the final state happens in California. He wins California, huge number of delegates there. The night he gives the acceptance speech in Los Angeles, he's assassinated. Famous scene, everyone knows. Now the Democratic Party's fortunes are in more turmoil. Their leading candidate, who has just won the California primary, is dead. Their vice president is unpopular within the party base because he's part of the Johnson-Humphrey administration. Eugene McCarthy is still sitting there as the anti-war candidate. All of this then descends on Chicago for the convention.
Is McCarthy considered the liberal wing of the party?
Yeah, progressive, liberal, certainly a dove, anti-war, you know, wanting to pull out of Vietnam and that process abruptly. So what happens at the convention? Inside the hall are the delegates, party insiders. They nominate Hubert Humphrey. Outside the hall are the young anti-war protesters who want to see Gene McCarthy or someone else, certainly not someone from the administration. And they're in violent conflicts with the police. Chicago police are trying to keep them away from the convention hall, and there's some bloody conflicts in the streets. In the end, Humphrey's nominated easily, despite not having run in any primaries or done things we expect candidates today to do. And there was outrage in the party from lots of groups, not just anti-war groups, but from women's groups and from African-Americans and from students and others saying, basically, the party doesn't look like us. How can it be that a party nominates someone who doesn't have any support from its key constituencies?
Largely because of the Vietnam legacy.
Yeah. So in a strange way, the Vietnam War leads to reforming of the nomination process. And the Democrats almost managed to win that election in November, despite getting behind Humphrey at the last moment. There was a third party candidate who pulled off a lot of Democratic votes in the South. And yet it was a close one. But after the election, the Democrats decided to form a commission that would propose reforms to the convention process. And that commission, known as the McGovern-Fraser Commission, named partly after George McGovern, who was a senator from South Dakota, and the first person to be nominated by the Democrats under the new rules.
Imagine that.
Helped draft that plan, and he was aware of how it worked. But it all comes out of that process and really sets up the system that we know and are familiar with today.
And that's something that the Republicans also picked up in some way?
Well, this is a funny part of the history. The parties do not have to use the same systems.
Right.
One could have primaries and one could have backdoor meetings or something. They could do whatever they want. But it's essentially the Democrats that continually innovate or revisit and tinker with their process. They change the dates of things. They change the rules for choosing delegates. They had this massive commission reform after 1968. And Republicans usually say, okay, we'll go along with that. We'll do that too. That's for the most part.
Really interesting.
For the most part. Yeah, Republicans are not interested in reinventing things each time, but they will typically adopt something similar to what the Democrats have.
So the Democrats in 72 then would be their next opportunity to develop this system. And in 72, let's see, they have, McGovern against Nixon running for a second term?
That's right.
How did that work out for them?
Yeah, right. So the Democrats have an open nomination in 72. They have a new set of rules from this McGovern-Fraser Commission that required that the states have a transparent system for choosing delegates to the convention. That's in contrast to the 68 convention, where the protesters were griping that there was not a transparent process that was permeable, that was open to them. So the Democrats adopt open processes in all of their states. And for many states, that meant just going to a primary system, because a primary allowed the public to vote directly on who the delegates would be to the national convention. There were also a number of other things done. The state parties adopted quotas to ensure that there were equal numbers of men and women as delegates going to the convention. That's still the rule. They adopted rules in some form that provided for better representation of minority groups, African Americans in particular. Those are still basically the rules for the Democrats. So 72 wasn't the full manifestation of the new rules, but it was starting of this process of having primaries and more attention to them and candidates running in them. And George McGovern, because he had written the rules, was aware of how important those events would be. And he had the backing of these young anti-war liberal activists, and they were willing to put in labor and help him, you know, be successful in the primaries. He became the nominee, but was a disaster as a general election candidate. And Nixon was easily reelected in a landslide. Yeah, as big as Johnson's landslide 8 years before. So it took a couple of election cycles, two or three election cycles, for the reforms to really kick in and gel to establish this full-fledged primary system with a gauntlet of events and eventually the debates and all the other things that would happen. And it took the party, the Democrats, a couple of cycles to figure out how to navigate this new system. They were used to doing insider deals at the convention. Now the deals were made essentially by voters in public.
Gosh, it's democratic.
It is democratic and open and dynamic, and it's essentially settling things before the convention rather than at the convention. So it wasn't until about 1980, a couple cycles later, that both parties had candidates emerge and had strategies developed that recognized how the new system worked, and they began to get a hold on it.
We're going to look at further how that new system worked and is working when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Barry Burton, who's giving us the lowdown on the whole nomination process when it comes to the U.S. presidency and those election years, which seem to come closer and closer together. We hear in recent years a lot about New Hampshire. We hear a lot about Iowa and candidates going to Iowa in particular lately, talking up ethanol and then maybe kind of soft pedaling it once they have accomplished what they want to accomplish in Iowa. What do they want to accomplish in Iowa or New Hampshire? And why do we hear about one and the other and then they kind of go back and forth?
Isn't it strange to have these two small states at the front of the line getting all the attention?
Yeah.
They really enjoy getting all the attention. They appreciate being at the front of the line. It is sort of happenstance that both of those states just ended up at the beginning of this kind of 3 or 4 month gauntlet of primaries and caucuses. Iowa ended up near the front because they had a system of caucuses for choosing nominees to all kinds of offices in their state. These caucuses would start with meetings at the precinct level where party members would get together and throw out names and vote on delegates who would then go to county level meetings. One step higher would happen a few weeks later, and there'd be some voting and some selecting of delegates there that would then telescope up to congressional districts, which would then telescope to the final meetings, which would be the state party conventions, typically in Des Moines in the summer. So to get through all those stages, you had to start the caucus meetings pretty early, like in the winter, in order to get through them all by the time of the state convention. So Iowa already had this caucus system, and then these McGovern-Frazier reforms happened after the 1968 convention, and that drew attention to primaries and caucuses, and candidates, as I mentioned, were figuring out how to navigate the new system. And there was this guy from Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who was planning a run for president in 1976 as an unknown Southern governor, young, early in his term. And he went to Iowa and campaigned and got a lot of attention. It wasn't something that candidates were doing at the time. And he managed to pull together a lot of caucus supporters in those early, that first round caucus that happens in the winter. And he finished first among the candidates who were on the caucus ballots. He actually finished second to none of the above, but no one remembered that. What they remembered is he's a giant killer who was ahead of these other mainstream, you know, household name Democrats. And he turned that into kind of a momentum that took him on to New Hampshire and to other states. Now, New Hampshire was also at the front of the line, also for kind of strangely historic reasons. In New Hampshire, like a lot of New England states, there's a town meeting that happens in the spring, where town budgets and other things are set. So there was already a political event that was happening in March or April. And they decided at some point to have a presidential preference primary piled on top of that as part of the spring happenings. It didn't mean anything. It was really just a beauty contest. People would express.
Almost more like a poll?
Yes. Yeah. Sort of a straw poll. Sometimes, you know, favorite sons or popular people would have their names put on the ballot. But after the reforms, suddenly those early primaries became important. And that became now the first state just in the lineup of things where a presidential primary was happening. So candidates began rushing to New Hampshire in the winter.
For its essentially symbolic value or just kind of media value?
Well, it had only media value early on. Both states choose delegates. So you do actually win something that can be used at the national convention. But the states are so small, they don't have very many delegates. It's something like 2% of all the national convention delegates come from these two states. So you're not going to win the nomination from the delegates alone you get in Iowa and New Hampshire, but you're going to get attention and hopefully a bounce that takes you as a candidate onto the next states. And you'll notice even this time around, the kind of sparse competition we had in 2024 on the Republican side, there were candidates who dropped out very quickly after not doing well in those first events. So they have a winnowing effect of reducing the field to a small number of people who then go on and compete in South Carolina, Nevada, Super Tuesday, the other events that are early on.
Who determines how many delegates these states get?
The national parties have rules, so many rules, long documents that describe exactly what the delegate allocation is. Republicans have something like 2,500 delegates to hand out. Democrats have about twice that many, so it's a much bigger convention. Each state gets a number of delegates based on a formula. That formula includes things like the population of the state, so bigger places get more, how supportive the state is of the party. So if you're a very blue state that delivers a lot of votes for the Democrats, you get more delegates as a kind of reward for that on the Democratic side, same on the Republican side. And then states that are willing to go later in the calendar season are rewarded with more delegates.
Because interesting.
So many of them want to be near the front because that's where the attention is. And often the race is settled by the time you get to the last states. So you'd prefer not to hold an election where no one comes. So states will jump to as far to the front as possible. Typically, Super Tuesday is the first date on which states can hold their events if they don't have special permission to be one of those early states. And that's also in the rules. So going late, having more support for your party, adopting rules the party likes will get you more delegates, but also might give you less influence in the process.
Is it one delegate, one vote for the nomination? How does that work?
That also is very complicated. It varies by party and it varies by state within party. So a general tendency is on the Democratic side, delegates tend to be given out proportionally based on how the candidates do in that state. So roughly speaking, if a candidate in the Democratic primary got 25% of the vote, they'd get something like 25% of the delegates. It's not exactly that. And it's often decided congressional district by congressional district, plus there's a statewide amount, plus there's a threshold that a candidate has to pass to get any. But that's sort of how the Democrats do things. Republicans tend to favor a kind of winner-take-all system that's more decisive. Again, it varies a little state by state. It is possible for multiple candidates to come out of a Republican primary and win delegates. But I'll just give you one example of that this time around. The Republicans in California actually changed their rules for 2024 so that if you run in the Republican primary in California and get more than half of the vote statewide, you get all of the delegates.
Winner take all.
Winner take all. So that's a new rule, and that was written to help Donald Trump because the thought was he's going to win more than half of the delegates in our state. Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, someone else might pick up 20 or 30%, but we want them to have zero. So the state party there, which has now been captured by the Trump forces, like so many state parties have, rewrote the rules and guaranteed he would get essentially all of the delegates from California. That's a little unusual, but there are a lot of states on the Republican side that work that way.
You occasionally hear about, I'm thinking of, for example, in the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, it being her turn to be the candidate once Obama had sort of almost usurped, you know, her place. Now it's her turn. Whether she's the one most likely to beat the Republican candidate or not, does that play out? I mean, would a party really be that hidebound for this kind of, oh, it's my turn thinking?
There is a little of that culture in both parties. That often a candidate who eventually becomes the nominee, will have had one run before where they didn't quite make it. But they make a lot of friends in the party along the way, and they develop skill as a candidate. They develop fundraising networks. They get endorsements. They figure out the rules. And so they're in a good place the next time around when there's an open contest. So, you know, on the, let's see, on the Republican side, there have been people like John McCain who have run for president before and failed in 2000. He came back in 2008, became the nominee. Mitt Romney had run at least once before in 2008 and then came back in 2012. Ronald Reagan had run in 1976, came back in 1980. The Democrats do a similar thing. Joe Biden had actually run for president multiple times over decades from the 1980s onward and had been vice president of the United States, obviously. And so was sort of set up to be that person as well. So there often is a kind of heir apparent. Not that it's handed to the person. They have to work for it, and it's not guaranteed. But they have just put together a kind of package of skills and connections and other things that are going to make them successful. This is another reason why Donald Trump just does not fit the historical pattern. He hadn't done any of that work in the party. He had not run. He had toyed with the idea, but he had never actually run for president in a serious way. He had no real connections in the Republican Party any more than he had in the Democratic Party. He'd given money to both sides and sort of made friends in politics, but managed to make it work for him in 2016.
How did he get the nomination in 2016? How would he get? Well, I guess 2020 may have been a different situation. But yes, how did he get the nomination, though? What was going on inside the Republican Party, especially in 2016?
Yeah, it was such a surprise. You know, the party, after it lost in 2012 to Obama's reelection with Mitt Romney, the party did soul searching and wrote a postmortem reviewing its failures. Reince Priebus, who had been the chair in the Republican Party in Wisconsin and at the national level, led that effort. And the things they talked about doing as a party to get back on track were the opposite of what Donald Trump ended up being. That report talked about reaching out to female voters. They had not done well with women, and so kind of softening the edge on things like abortion, and reaching out to Hispanic voters and softening their message on immigration. And Trump was neither of those things, no. But managed to be the nominee just 4 years later. So how did that happen? One is it was a gigantic field of Republicans who ran in 2016. It was, at the time, historic. I think it was 17 Republicans who were in the mix. Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz. It was a long list. John Kasich, of actually well-known establishment Republicans, kind of traditional, credible candidates, but a big field. So those traditional candidates were splitting the vote. Kind of regular Republicans, you know, the Ronald Reagan-type Republicans would have been interested in Marco Rubio and Scott Walker and all of them kind of equally. Donald Trump was different from all of them. So that was one factor, was the big field. Second was that he arrived at the campaign with a social media and public following that no one else had. He had millions of Twitter followers before he started the campaign.
And was not for politics, just for personality.
Because of The Apprentice and his business, you know, visibility and those kinds of things. So he used that platform, which cost him nothing, to communicate directly with voters. And that was very successful. And he had his own wealth. He flew around on his own jet. And so funded the campaign totally differently from other candidates. While they were off the campaign trail, often doing fundraising, he was flying around in the Trump jet doing more events.
Didn't work that well for Ross Perot, but again, he didn't quite have the media coverage.
That's right. And then the other factor are these rules I mentioned, the kind of winner-take-all system that gets used in so many Republican primaries. Trump rarely won a majority of the primary vote in 2016. He lost in Iowa. He came second to Ted Cruz. He won New Hampshire, and then he started winning more states, but he was winning with 30% of the vote or 35% of the vote. But with a winner-take-all rules, he was getting essentially all the delegates. So he was racking up. He had no endorsements from party leaders, but he was winning delegates from voters who were showing up in primaries. And so as those rolled up, other candidates realized, people like Marco Rubio and Scott Walker, we have no chance to compete with this guy. He has a kind of magic and is doing just enough in a big field to keep winning a sizable enough percentage to get delegates. And I think by the time the party realized he was the nominee, it was too late, and they had not taken action to stop him in any coordinated way before. So it worked.
So he had a plurality. He didn't have a majority of the votes in the Republican Party, but he had a plurality. And if he had had 36% and somebody else, Rubio or whoever, had 35, would that be winner take all for Trump?
It would depend on the state. Probably if that had happened in a particular state's primary, both of them would have gotten some delegates. Again, it's often by congressional district, and then there's a statewide amount. Some states have the kind of California rule I mentioned earlier, where you might get everything, but often it's district by district. So if it had been a one-on-one contest between Trump and one other regular kind of Republican, I think the delegates would have been divided more evenly. You know, that was part of Hillary Clinton's difficulty getting the nomination that same year, as she was up against Bernie Sanders, and they were going back and forth head to head right through the end of it. And Trump didn't have that. It was Trump versus a lot of other people. And those other people were splitting up the rest of the vote in a way that splintered and got none of them very many delegates and allowed Trump to add to his total each time.
So in that sense, a splintered party can be to the advantage of the candidate, at least in the till he gets to the general election.
That's right. And there's kind of an irony in that, because Republicans adopt the rules they do to try to prevent a fringe candidate or a candidate with a small base of support, a small but extreme base of support, to do well. You know, the Republicans had been stung in the past with people like Ron Paul, who did not represent the heart of the party, would never have gotten the nomination at an old style convention, but had this kind of ardent group of supporters who were with him in the primaries. And he caused real trouble for the Republicans in 2008, maybe in 2012, he ran again. And so they actually modified some of the rules to try to keep those fringe candidates down, but they had not thought about a candidate like Donald Trump. So as the parties are constantly modifying their processes, especially on the Democratic side, but both parties constantly modifying, and they're typically trying to solve a problem that caused them difficulty last time, and they are not anticipating what the new problem will be for them. And in this case, it wasn't a problem. It was a success that Trump was the nominee, and then he defeated the candidate who most people thought was the likely winner in November.
Although there is plenty of dissent in the Republican Party, and we'll see how it all plays out. It has been a fascinating look, and I'm sure we could have another look before too long and see how things might have changed. It's been a pleasure, Barry Burden.
It's been great being with you. Thanks.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.